Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The Democratic primary field shrank this week, that is, before it expanded again with billionaire Tom Steyer entering the race. But anyway, California Congressman Eric Swalwell became the first candidate to drop out following the initial Democratic debate. As listeners may have noticed, we don't generally interview candidates while they're running for the presidency on this podcast. There are various reasons for that, but a big one is that it can be hard to get candidates who are actively seeking the presidency to be candid. So we're going to try something a little different. Instead of speaking to candidates while they're running, we're going to speak with them once they've left the race. Think of this as an exit interview, a place where, like at any company, candidates can be candid about their thoughts as they head off to pursue other things. And here with me to kick things off is Congressman Eric Swalwell. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Step into my HR office. For starters, why are you leaving the race?
Well, you know, it's tough to leave. I really enjoyed being out there and, you know, being in the mix, especially on the issue of gun violence. But, you know, I ran for one reason and one reason only, and that was to win. And I believed if we won, we would make a big difference in the country. And when that did not seem viable, it was, you know, time to leave. And, you know, I told my family and my staff and my friends and everyone who supported us that we'd be honest about our chances every step along the way. And as soon as it did not become viable, that we would get out. And as long as it was viable, we would run as hard as we could because we knew what was at stake.
What did you maybe dislike most about running for president?
You know, I mean, the days are grueling. And I'll just first say, I have a lot of respect for anyone who has run in the past, especially those who have won, because, you know, you see when you're out on the trail what it takes and just how, you know, how many places you have to be, how long the days are, you know, how focused you have to stay, and you can't get taken off your game. Otherwise, you know, mistakes happen. So you'd have these days where you start, you know, 6, 7 a.m., you know, to catch an early flight. And then you're, you know, getting to bed by, you know, midnight or touching down at midnight. And, you know, those days, the travel sucks. But what was worse, the worst part, I would say, of doing this was a delay. Because, like, you can, like, prepare for a 6 a.m. flight and, like, then going a whole day and then taking another flight at the end of the day and landing just before midnight. But the second there's a delay, you're just like, oh man, it, like, this sucks. Plus it's delayed. So that was the toughest part. But, you know, honestly, I mean, there were so many exciting parts, you know, of the journey, and, you know, just people who put everything, like, they put their trust, they give you their hopes, they tell you things that they only tell their spouses. And that was, you know, quite fulfilling. And it made you want to get up the next day, even if it was, you know, a delayed flight or a long day, and do it again.
I know that during your campaign, you were emphasizing gun violence and student debt, but I do want to hear a little bit about your electoral strategy, right? It's a deep field, a lot of people out there. Let us peek behind the curtain a little bit. What did you originally see as your path to the nomination?
Well, certainly with so many people in the field, you know, I believed that we had to have a niche issue that, you know, just for starters, you know, we could have positions on all sorts of issues and policies on all sorts of issues, but we needed something that people would say, okay, that's his issue. And then ideally, if they open the door and they come in, then they want to look at other issues, and the boldness that we would show on gun violence, they would see on student loan debt and on healthcare cures and on, you know, having hopefully a publicly financed, you know, campaign system. But you had to kind of get them in the door, I guess, so to speak. You needed, you know, that issue that, you know, would make them want to do that. And so for us, you know, we thought gun violence was the most important issue that did not have a champion. And as a former prosecutor and someone who's on the Judiciary Committee and who went to Congress when Sandy Hook happened, you know, that issue, you know, it felt natural to be a, you know, a top issue for us. And it also, we just found, you know, was polling. In the internal polling that we reviewed, it was an issue that we thought was kind of a sleeper issue, meaning that, you know, a lot of candidates would perceive it as being, you know, too hot of a stove to touch. But we saw with a lot of the polling that, you know, voters wanted, Republican and Democratic voters wanted action on it.
Were there particular places in the country that were key to how you wanted to run your race?
Well, you know, I was born in Iowa, and so, you know, I know the state well. You know, it was just by accident that I was born there. I don't think my parents had any designs on me doing this. But, you know, we figured, you know, taking a candidacy where you're born in Iowa, you know the state really well, you know the issues there well, but also, you know, representing a diverse district in California, you know, that would be, you know, a pathway that could break through. And again, you know, it didn't.
Yeah, but why don't you think it ended up happening?
You know, frankly, I think it was there are so many heavyweights, you know, in this field. And, you know, it was just, you know, as I said, hard to break through. And, you know, the refrain that I heard a lot from people was, you know, I love that you're running. I love the issue that you're going to take on. I think you're probably going to be president one day, but probably not, you know, this election, which is kind of like, you know, cold comfort. But I think, you know, there was a lot of talent in the field, and I wasn't comfortable doing anything other than being myself. And if, you know, doing something other than being myself was the way to break through, you know, I wasn't willing to do that.
So I want to talk a little bit about the rest of the field. It's a deep field. From what I understand, you aren't endorsing anyone. But what characteristics do you think the Democratic nominee should have?
Confidence.
Okay.
So if someone has gone through this, you know, your psyche is tested every single hour. It's not every single day. Every single hour, I mean, your psyche is tested. You're going into a new room, you know, sometimes every 20 minutes to 30 minutes, sometimes every hour. You're giving a speech in front of 5,000 people. You're giving a speech in front of, you know, 25 people. And, you know, as you're doing that, news on the outside is happening. Polls are coming in. You know, your operation is getting stood up, or it's having issues. And like just keeping your confidence, you know, all the way through and projecting that to every new person you meet or every reporter that you're being interviewed with, I think is probably the hardest, you know, part of this, because, you know, ultimately the person who emerges is going to be contrasted with Donald Trump. And he is a very confident person. And he is, you know, someone who I think is the best puncher ever in American politics. And so, you know, our candidate, I think, you know, is going to have to be someone who can, you know, really weather that and, you know, be able to punch back with, you know, their own ideas. And I mean, this is going to be a rough and tumble race. And so I think whoever just has the most confidence in themselves and their own ideas is going to be the most important trait as far as, you know, what it takes to get through.
Okay, because there's a bunch of different variables here in terms of policy positions or identities.
Yep.
I mean, are there any more specifics that you can get into in terms of what you think would be successful as the Democratic nominee?
I think authenticity also, you know, authenticity really, really matters. And, you know, I think it's whoever is perceived as like they say this because they believe this. And, you know, I know this may sound counterintuitive to a lot of people, especially Democrats, but I think Donald Trump was, you know, perceived among all of the candidates, you know, in 2016 on both sides as one of the more authentic candidates, meaning that like people assumed that, you know, he was saying what he believed. And then when he became president, he has sought to do almost everything that he said, you know, he would do. They're awful things. I mean, they're un-American. They're, you know, worker, anti-woman, anti-immigrant, but he is, you know, he is authentic in that sense, that he is like stuck to what he said he was going to do. And most people believe that he probably talks behind closed doors the same way that he talks, you know, to the public. And I think it's important that, you know, our candidate can do that too. And so authenticity is going to matter. And then I just happen to think that, you know, a next generation candidate, if you look at historically, who has won, you know, since President Kennedy, from Kennedy to Carter to Clinton to Obama, who has won as the Democratic nominee? It's always been a page forward. And, you know, I don't think that's an accident. I think that is, you know, that there's a correlation there. And so I do think a page forward candidate, and I don't mean that by age at all. I mean that just mindset and, you know, just, you know, kind of length of, you know, service in government, so to speak, but someone who is, you know, kind of perceived as like a page forward. We're not, you know, going back in time.
of course, you told Biden during the first debate to pass the torch to the next generation. Do you think the party should nominate somebody in their 70s?
He has, I think, one of the best chances to beat President Trump. He is, I think, seen as authentic. Like, people don't believe, I think when he says something, people believe he's saying, you know, what he believes in. You know, and I think we all think of that, you know, this is a big fucking deal moment that, you know, that Biden had. Like, that was like authentic Joe Biden coming out. And I think the more that that shows, you know, the more that he's going to meet that test of it. I think, you know, to pass the next generation test, I mean, it's, again, what concerns me is just having someone who's been in politics, you know, for so long that people may believe that that person has been around for so long that they would not be capable of taking on these issues that have persisted. And, you know, I think other candidates, you know, would make a better case. But again, Joe Biden's a nominee. I think for other reasons, you know, it could just end up being, you know, people want the experienced adult in the room. And that is also, I think, maybe enough to beat Donald Trump.
So who counts as the next generation among the candidates? So probably somebody who hasn't been in politics for decades, as you mentioned. I mean, it seems like age would have to play a role in this, but I don't know. So who left do you think?
I'll say Elizabeth Warren.
Counts.
I mean, I don't see her as a I see Senator Warren, you know, is somebody who is a page forward to me in the sense that she's not spent her career, you know, in elected politics. She has, you know, she's, you know, and I think in her second term now, in the first, no, she's still in her first term. Yeah, you know, don't quote me on that. I think she's first or second term in the Senate. Second term in the Senate. So, and her ideas, I think, are fresh ideas on, you know, student loans, on, you know, family leave, you know, on child care. You know, she's taking on issues that generationally, you know, like the next generation are really affected by, and she sees those issues. So that's why I'm hesitant to say it's an age as much as it's a mindset. And so that, you know, Vice President Biden, I think if he, you know, starts speaking up on those next generation issues, can reach, you know, those voters.
So depending on the poll, about half of Democratic voters say that they prioritize nominating somebody who is electable, able to beat Trump, over nominating someone they agree with on all the issues. And that's somewhat unique to this particular year. That number hasn't been as high during past cycles. What do you make about this conversation about electability in the race? Is it an important focus?
It is an important focus, and we can't survive four more years. I mean, it's the anxiety of what four more years would look like. You know, I think the country has, you know, just collectively aged, you know, through this, you know, presidency that, you know, this is, it may be four, you know, calendar years, but like it's probably taken, you know, 40 years off of all of our lives is how it feels in many ways. And so I do see this as, you know, people view Donald Trump as a, you know, a threat, an existential threat, you know, to democracy, that if he were to get four more years, it may be longer than that, you know, knowing, you know, the way that he views, you know, power.
So some critics of this whole conversation about electability have seen electability as a code word for just a straight white man. That's the kind of person that can beat Donald Trump. Do you see that as being part of the conversation? What do you think of that?
I hope not. I don't want to, you know, I don't think any of us want to be in a country where that is the case. What I think it just has to mean is, as I said, is the candidate confident? Are they authentic? And are they a page forward? Those are kind of the three factors that I look at for electability. I don't look at the, you know, the policy platforms as much as electability. And I think that Donald Trump has thrown that out. I mean, he took wildly unpopular policy positions, you know, that were outside the mainstream, you know, during the last election, still won. And I think, you know, a lot of that was he ran a change race. He had confidence. He was seen as authentic, and he wasn't, you know, your ordinary, you know, establishment politician. And so that worked. And so I think we can do the same thing. I happen to think, though, that with Donald Trump, the way to beat him, you know, if your candidate is confident, authentic, and Next Generation. I think if you're just thinking about a policy on electability, it's healthcare, that he is most vulnerable there, that's his Achilles heel on policy. And someone who has the discipline, I guess, to really just stick to that is one of the principal issues I think will really expose how vulnerable he is.
I want to ask you a little bit about some of the issues, but do you think that in general, this conversation about electability has made it harder to run as a woman in this race than it is to run as a man?
I don't think so. Half of the top four candidates right now, are women. I actually think that, you're going to see, I think Senators Harris and Warren, have real staying power in this race. And I think you're going to see them go at least to Super Tuesday, just from my, evaluation. So, no, I don't see that at all. Is an issue for them. I mean, again, it may be something that's speculated about, but with voter my conversations with voters, that's not an issue.
In terms of policy, it seems like there is a bit of a divide among Democrats today over how far to push to the left. A bunch of presidential candidates have sided with that left flank on the Green New Deal, decriminalizing crossing the border, Medicare for all, and various other positions. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as a general election risk?
No, and the reason I say that is because, especially on healthcare, and that's why it's going to be so critical on the three issues you just laid out, that healthcare is paramount. Because what they see with President Trump is that he went in and disrupted healthcare without any plan to make it better. So he took a system that was albeit controversial in the sense that, there wasn't unanimity in the country about whether everyone wanted the Affordable Care Act or not, but it at least expanded access to healthcare. And he has tried to dismantle that and has offered no alternative. And so even if you have a candidate, like Senator Warren, who, is advocating for a single payer system, I think for most Americans, they may think like, that's not what I want, but that plan is addition and multiplication, and Donald Trump's plan is subtraction and division. And I think addition and multiplication, when it comes to healthcare, is always going to win.
But on the other issues, so for example, decriminalizing crossing the border, recent polling has shown that that's underwater with the American public. In terms of the Green New Deal, Speaker Nancy Pelosi has been not very enthusiastic about that. I mean, it seems like there are large swaths of the American public and even Democrats who are not keen on a lot of these positions that almost all of the people running for president seem to be embracing. What's going on there?
Yeah, again, I think Democrats tend to tiptoe around issues that are perceived as unpopular, whereas Republicans have no problem, leading with very unpopular issues. So, the overwhelming majority of Americans support a woman's right to choose. However, Republicans lead on that issue and they're unapologetic about it and they don't pay a price at the ballot box. And I would go as far to say the same about the Second Amendment. The overwhelming majority of Americans want, restrictions on gun ownership. But the Republicans, they very much, that is a litmus test for, any Republican, and they run on it. And so I think for us, being unapologetic about wanting to address climate chaos and being unapologetic about wanting to expand access to healthcare, can be a winner. I'm going to talk now as to your immigration question. That is one of the more, complex of those three issues, in that, you're dealing with security, but also, humanitarian issues. And Donald Trump is masterful at taking that issue, which is very complex, and just saying, open borders, murderers, rapists, take your jobs. And he has defined the issue in very quickly. And Democrats are in a position of saying, well, we need comprehensive reform. We should staple a green card to a diploma. We need fate for the dreamers. We need a smart wall, but not a border wall. We need a Marshall Plan in Central America to understand, why people are coming. All I think are where most Americans are if you could get their attention and talk to them, about this issue. But it's much harder to say that, in a headline, that's more for fine print. Yeah. And Donald Trump, you know, he thrives in the headlines. So I'm proposing to you, we should not let him define immigration as the most important issue to Americans. If he can do that, if he can convince Americans that the most important issue in their life is immigration, it's very hard for us to take the complexity of that issue and put out our position in a way that we can win. And so I think you have to be dismissive of immigration as being the most important issue. One, because it is not the most important issue. And two, tactically, if he can make it the most important issue, you know, it's a higher ground for him.
Do you think that Nancy Pelosi is mistaken when she pushes back against the left flank of the party?
You know, she has a different role to play than anyone else, you know, in Congress. I mean, she is, as I often describe it, she's the conductor, you know, of the symphony. And so her job, you know, I mean, yes, she's a representative, but she also, you know, as conductor, she has to make sure everyone's instruments are tuned, that we're all singing off the same sheet or performing off the same, you know, sheet of music. And, you know, that's a much harder job than anyone else has. I don't think there's a person who's done that better, at least in my lifetime.
Isn't that because she wants to keep the party, or at least in her view, electable and be able to maintain a majority in the House, which would be probably the same thing that a Democratic nominee would want, to be broadly electable across the country? So why would the calculus for Nancy Pelosi in terms of impeachment or the Green New Deal or immigration be that much different from what the calculation should be for the eventual Democratic nominee?
Well, you know, Nancy Pelosi is leading individuals who have to run, you know, in districts of 750,000, you know, roughly people. And so what plays in Omaha is dramatically different than what plays, you know, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Now, the nominee, you know, can, you know, I think
can lose Nebraska.
We should still compete there. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, for example, you know, opportunities, you know, in the Midwest, in that we just won congressional seats in Kansas and Oklahoma and Texas and Iowa. And Barack Obama, if you remember, won Indiana, you know, in Iowa. And so, you know, if you have a change candidate, you know, they can turn out and inspire people. And so I think that the presidential candidate, you know, is just very different than, you know, what Nancy Pelosi has to do, which is to deliver a majority for whoever that nominee is, so that nominee, you know, ultimately the president, can be effective.
All right, I want to continue this conversation in just a minute, but first, today's podcast is brought to you by Lightstream. Are you tired of credit card bills with high interest rates? Ready to pay off your credit card balances and start saving money? Get a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream with rates as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay. That's lower than average credit card interest rates of over 19% APR. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with no fees. The rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. Plus, you can even get your money in your bank account as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience. Right now, when you apply, you can get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. It's subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. All right, so I want to turn back to the field a little bit. Depending on how you count, there are about 25 people running for president. Now maybe there's 24. I think it went down to 23 for a second. Anyway, why do you think there are so many people running for president?
I think it's the urgency of the Trump presidency and what he's done to our country. And I think, I really believe people, they see this country that we love, you know, on the ropes, and they want to get in the ring and, you know, save it. That's why I did it.
Is there any sense that the incentives for running for president are a little bit out of whack in terms of people want to increase their name recognition or sell books or things like that? I mean, we've never had this many people run for president before. We've had plenty of unpopular presidents.
You know, I understand why someone who has not run for president would say that. And I have to be mindful of that and not dismiss it. But I can just tell you, as someone, you know, who had two kids in the last you know, 25 months, you know, that is the worst way, I think, to increase your profile is, you know, to be away, you know, from
to
your
run
family
for president?
As often as you have to be. Yeah, I mean, I think there's other ways to increase your profile that are not as taxing. Like what you give up to do it, certainly, you know, you lose time, you know, with your family, you lose time with your friends. I mean, you kick the shit out of your body, you know, going all over the place. You're eating, you know, at the worst hours. It's you're not exercising. So, you know, I don't know if everyone else, you know, has the same lifestyle as I do, but I certainly did not, you know, get younger or richer or I would say more valuable in any measurable sense by doing it. I did it, you know, because I wanted to win and make a difference. And I just assume that that's why, you know, the overwhelming majority of the candidates, you know, are doing it. But I get that sentiment. But I think these are we have a serious field. I mean, you have, you know, former cabinet secretaries, you know, you have vice presidents, senators. I mean, they're all qualified in their own respect. And I see them, you know, in the most remote places of the country at the, you know, most oddest times of the day. And I just have to believe that they genuinely want to lead this country. And again, it's a lot to give up to, like, maybe increase your profile or maybe sell a book.
Do you think that it's a good thing for the party and for Democratic voters that there are 25 people running for the Democratic nomination? This is a studied subject in political science, and there are potential downsides, right? Like when you have a broad primary field, historically, that can produce factional candidates who don't help form any kind of party consensus. Is it a good thing that there are 25 people? If your average voter in Iowa mm-hmm. is trying to choose between 25 people who are running for president?
So, you know, selfishly, I would say if the field was half of that, I think our candidacy would still be in the field right now. So I wish the field was smaller. But if the alternative to 25 people running is, you know, one person running or three or four people running as we had in 2016, I don't think that served us, you know, well either. So I think you're going to see through this, you know, process in very short order, the field is going to be truncated significantly and that a leader is going to emerge. And because that person went through the most grueling primary our party's ever seen, they will be that much stronger and they'll have to be that much stronger to take on President Trump.
Is there any pressure on candidates to drop out and help winnow the field?
There was no pressure on me, certainly. And the hardest part for me was, you know, I got out of the race about a week and a half after the end of the quarter. And so the end of the quarter, you know, the end of June was, you know, right after, a couple days after the debate. And so, you know, I put a lot of time into calling my supporters and calling, you know, our donors. And I was going to gauge, you know, whether to stay in or not based on how they perceived me doing in the debate. And so I thought, if no one's taking my calls, if I'm just going straight to voicemail, you know, or, you know, getting put on a spam list, you know, then that's easy. I'm gonna get out. That's not what happened at all. Like when our report comes out in a couple of days, folks will see that we had tremendous support in the last few days of the quarter. And so very few people were saying, get out. In fact, they were saying, you know, you made your points during the debate, like good luck.
I don't mean by rank and file voters. I mean, more, of course,
my point is
the party's interest probably to start to winnow the field. Are there people from the DNC or the state parties?
No.
Like talking to candidates being like, you know, this field's got to winnow at some point, like TikTok.
No. So again, is my point was, so I'm not hearing it from supporters at all. For me, it was looking at the polling after the debate and seeing that we weren't moving and that I would have to go back and justify to more and more donors how we could stay in and more volunteers who you'd need to make phone calls and knock doors when you're not moving. So for me, it was just the reality of the fundamentals aren't changing for us. And so, like, what purpose does it serve if, we're not going to win, and just a self-assessment of, I don't want to be in such a crowded field when there are clear candidacies that, if the field were narrower, would probably have a chance. And so,
would you encourage other people to consider dropping out?
No, you know, it's, and I have so many friends running. You know, I went to three weddings of people who are, you know, running for president right now. And so, no, I would, it's such a personal, you know, decision. And I, as I talk to all of them about this, you know, they have their own reasons and they see their own path. And I think they're going to have the same self-assessment that I did, if they haven't already. And again, the DNC, I think the best thing that they're doing is increasing the threshold. And so I think it's really hard if you're not on the debate stage, you know, going into September to justify why you're in the race if you can't meet that threshold. And I think that's credit to, you know, the DNC, because again, as much as we're talking right now about how big the field is, in 2 months, it's going to be 6 to 8 people. And I think that'll be a distant past that we had such a crowded field. It's going to really narrow to those 6 to 8 people.
So September is the time to kind of look at yourself in the mirror. Okay. So with regards to those debates, last few questions here, do you think that the DNC's threshold, specifically in terms of donor criteria, which was new this year, putting an emphasis on individual donations so that campaigns spend a lot of money just getting $1 from a bunch of different people, which is, when you think about it in terms of efficiency, a kind of a weird way to run a campaign. Like, does that make sense in the future?
So I don't like it. And we, you know, I think 1 month spent, you know, $110,000-ish to get $100,000. So it's like you're like spending money to get, you know, less money just to meet a threshold. And it doesn't allow for the resources you need, you know, to organize in Iowa, in New Hampshire, in South Carolina, in Nevada. But that being said, with so many candidates, like, I appreciate why they, you know, felt the need to not just have a polling criteria, but also to, you know, maybe have a second way to measure the field. So it's almost like democracy, right? It's the worst form of government except for all other forms of government. So this was the worst way of doing it except for probably all other, you know, options that they had. And again, I wanted the threshold to go up because I wanted to move up with the threshold and I wanted to see the field shrink. And my best chance was if I was in a, you know, less crowded field, because I believe that we had that electability feature to us, but that it was not going to show in such a crowded field. We didn't grow with the field, so, you know, we didn't grow as the field was starting to shrink, so we got out. But I do credit the DNC with having a function to shrink the field. It's needed.
Having run in the primary, are there other things that you can think of in terms of how you could make the primary process better going forward? You know, quintessential HR question here.
Right. You know, that's a great question. I guess, and again, this may sound crazy, but, you know, if they did 2 debates with 10 people, I mean, they could have filled the whole week and done, you know, 4 debates with 5. I mean, it's just the debate stage that was hard. You know, I looked at the numbers, you know, the next morning, and, you know, Vice President Biden got about almost 15 minutes. I got just under 5 minutes, and I mean, he certainly should get more time, but I felt like it was really hard to contrast yourself, and then you're in this position of like, how often am I jumping in? And you know, I don't want to be obnoxious, but I want to make my point. And, you know, at the end of the day, like, what would the DNC lose by having 4 debates? You know, and it actually, I think you would see,
well, maybe
there's
viewers,
such intense,
right,
interest that might,
would
might have had
viewers?
4 days of viewership.
All right. Well, thank you for giving us this exit interview. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And I hope I get a bonus.
We'll see. We'll see.
All right. Thanks, Galen.
I've been speaking with Congressman Eric Swalwell from California's 15th Congressional District. That was our first exit interview of the 2020 primary. Let us know what you thought. Should we keep doing these? Talk to more candidates as they drop out? Was it educational for you? Let us know. Until next week, I'm Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.